The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
In a moment, we'll talk about Baltimore because my next guest has been looking at that situation there and the implications for global trade. But first, we had invited him in to talk about flying cars. The tech behind a flying car, originally developed and successfully test flown in Europe, has been bought by a Chinese firm. This particular car was powered by a BMW engine, used normal fuel, and it actually flew, it's a what they call an air car, for 35 minutes between two Slovakian airports in 2021. Using runways for takeoff and landing. So to talk about cars and ultimately also about Baltimore, we are joined by Kevin Byrne, retired Lieutenant Colonel and Airport Safety and Security Auditor. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
So we wanted to talk about the air car because the popular use of an air car was looming in Paris for the Olympics, but...
It was. That's bad news, unfortunately. If you have your tickets to get into the Olympics, that's going to go ahead. No problem with that. But you're not going to fly across the city in the Volocopter, as they called it, from Volo Ports, because the company making them could not get the certification required from the European Aviation Safety Agency because it's just too short a time.
So in the way you might go to a helicopter, a heliport in New York, for example, to get that terrifying tour over Manhattan Island, which I've done, they were going to... literally bring you to the Olympics in an air taxi.
There were four or five places you'd fly in and out, missing all of the traffic, being secure and safe and all that kind of thing in daylight and at night indeed. But of course the European aviation safety people have said, no, this needs to be certified for passenger carriage in exactly the same way as Boeing and Airbus would do it. And you need something like 100,000 flying hours to prove that, and they have not done it yet.
Yeah, and they're not going to get it done before the Olympics.
Not. So come back in 2025, they said. However, there will be a couple of aircraft on demonstration, and if you're a celebrity or you're an athlete or perhaps a journalist, they might give you a spin around the town, so to speak. But I wouldn't buy a ticket anytime soon.
Okay, now what is the state of development then of the air car generally? This Slovakian car, first of all.
It's produced by a company called Klein Vision, and it was very radical looking. It looks a little bit like a Ferrari with wings that are tied down the side, and they come out and they lock in place, and they've got twin booms.
So it's kind of
a hybrid, you'd call it.
Yeah, it's like it flies as a fixed wing, though.
Oh, it does. And the problem with that is you need a runway. And the other problem with it is while it runs perfectly well on your 140 brake horsepower, 1.6 litre BMW engine on motor gasoline, MoGas or fuel, unleaded we would call it, it has to be converted. And that's easy enough. It does it automatically and it will fly faster than it will drive on the ground. It's limited to 160 kilometres an hour on the runway, on the motorway, which is no problem, but it does 200 kilometres an hour in the air and it'll run at 18 litres an hour, which is quite economical, really. So it's good from that point of view. The trouble is you can drive it with your current EU licence, not a problem, but you need a pilot's licence to go into the airport, convert it and run off the runway and take off and get into
the system. Okay, so it's not the car for every man or woman.
No, but for 50, 60, 70 years they've been trying to devise a car that will be able to convert to an aircraft, and this is as close as we're going to get as far as I can tell in the short term.
Now, this kind of thing where you go on a runway, you boot up to whatever your takeoff speed is depending on the wingspan that gives you lift, and off you go. That's one way of doing things, but we already have drones which can hover in the air, which can deliver payloads, be it weapons or, in our case, food, to the doorstep. So is that not the more likely technology, that you'd have vertical liftoff from your back garden or whatever, up you go into the sky, cross the M50, look down at all the people stuck in the traffic and land in a patch of grass somewhere near Croke Park and go to the match?
That sounds good too, but the trouble with that is, of course, you're range limited. I mean, how long will a battery power your aircraft for? And I think they're pushing it now to about 40 minutes like that, so 20 minutes out, 20 minutes back. This air car can fly for 3 or 4 hours, so you've got a distance between 600 and 800. It's a different kind of
model. Obviously, your battery is weight. That's got to be lifted. And that is, at the moment, with battery technology, it's limiting.
It is. And when you land for the second time, you have to plug it in somewhere. And that's going to be a problem. Whereas you just top up the tank of your lovely air car and away you go. The only snag about the air car, by the way, is the price now. And it might differ when it goes to China. The Chinese company have invested heavily. They've taken it on board and they're going to produce it apparently on a production line in some of the factories in China.
I wonder, would a technology like the range extender that the old BMW i3 had when it came out first... a small little motorbike engine chugging away, recharging maybe a smaller battery.
Yeah,
now,
that,
I know
you're defeating the purpose
the law
in some
of perpetual
way.
Motion and all that comes in, but that kind of technology. So it's down in Croke Park. You have a few gallons of fuel and it chugs away, recharging while you're at the match.
That could work indeed. I think they're going they're going to be in a feature of the life of the next 20, 30 years. There's no two ways about that, because the technology always pushes us forward from that point of view.
Now, who else is doing it? Other countries? I mean, is America doing it? Is Australia doing
it? Yes, they are indeed. There is an interesting one. If you can't afford the 500,000 euros for your air car, you could spend something similar on the Netherlands-based PAL-V two-seater gyrocopter. Now, that's a little thing that looks like a motorbike on three wheels on the ground. Very neat and tidy, sort of thing you drive across America maybe. But you can stop and the rotor blades come out and pop up and the engine pushes you into the sky. So it's like a helicopter.
And it's a very short takeoff.
Very short takeoff. Takes off in 100 metres from that point of view. It'll fly at 180 kilometres an hour and it again uses about 7 litres per 100 kilometres. So it's quite economical.
Okay, and one presumes that if the engine failed,
yes,
you can auto-gyro down, because that is the nature of the
design. That is the nature of it. And also they give you a free, if you buy one of these things, probably costing 500,000. The first 90 are set for production right now. So, you know, rush out and buy one while you can. They give you free a pilot's license. You will need a pilot's license, unfortunately, whereas your driving
license. I thought you were going to say a parachute. A free parachute.
Well, it's a very safe, and it will be approved apparently for purposes by the European Aviation Safety Agency, probably before the air car.
Now, we are going to have food deliveries by drone. Already it's been piloted in parts of Dublin.
Indeed.
So that's going to be the future. But if one of these landed on your head, I mean, can they be controlled if they lose power?
They can. They're much safer in some ways than other aircraft, because they will find a patch and land safely like that. I was just looking up the website of MANA, the company doing it now around the Dublin area. The drones will fly at about 165 to 215 feet, which is quite low, but they have software in to avoid crashing into things like high buildings, antennae, wires and that kind of thing. And when it makes a delivery, it goes down to a height of about 50 feet above your head, and it drops your particular parcel.
It lowers it down.
And you take it, it'll be there for 40 seconds, you collect it and away you go. So they say the route's proven will make them very safe, and there'll be no difficulty going to and from the depot from which they
okay,
fly.
Okay, so no low-flying aircraft.
No, and the problem about the noise, which was a thing that neighbours said, we can't have that by day and by night. No, this thing will have less than 50 decibels, so a car passing by or a bus will make more noise than that. So you will not know it's there.
So it's a glimpse of the future through this food delivery.
I think it will happen. It will happen for sure in the next year or so. So expect to see it coming to a place near you.
Now, your normal subject is aviation, but you're also a student of what happens on the ocean wave, and you've been looking at Baltimore.
Indeed.
The craft itself, tell us about it. What was it carrying? What speed was it going?
Yeah, well, my aviation is my main business, as you know, but I've had tours of 12 different deep sea ports in different parts of the world, from North America across to the Asian and so forth. And I haven't been to Baltimore except on the train past it, but it's a very major port, as you know. This ship was doing what it should do, leaving port at the prescribed limit of 8 knots, because inside ports there's always a speed limit and it goes through it. It had 4,700 containers on board, and the ship weighed not in excess of 95,000 metric tons. That's an enormous energy, if you know, to push along like that.
Now, it had a capacity for much more than that.
Yes, it only had half loads. It can carry 10,000 20-foot containers or equivalents thereof. So it's a very, it's a very efficient vessel and is used to ship, you know, all sorts of things from different parts of the world. Heading for Singapore, as far as I remember. So
it was going at the maximum speed allowable, one presumes, 8 knots within the port.
Indeed, yes. And it's a fairly narrow water at 50 feet. It's not particularly deep, but it's very busy, very well managed. It had two pilots on board, which was a question I wanted to see answered. So these pilots help the captain and tell him exactly what course to
steer. So these are local guys.
Yes.
And they get on board, and it happens in a lot of ports.
In Dublin, in big ports.
You get the experts coming on to guide the captain who may never have been there before.
Exactly. The captain takes their instructions, but it's up to him to steer the aircraft. The ship. He's still in charge. The captain is in charge. They give him advice and help, assistance.
Now, what is known to have happened? because they had a catastrophic power failure for some reason.
It looks like that because the lights, if you watch the video, two or three things happen straight away. The lights flash. That's extremely unusual in a ship because they've got different power systems and they've got backups like that. And they want navigation lights and safety lights. All these failed for a short number of seconds. They came on again, so it was an intermittent fault. And then it looks as if the power plant has been hit to full power to try and reverse it. I think they put it into full reverse knowing there was a problem. But they also lost steering, so I'm not sure if the steering is at the angle they should be or whether it, you know,
diverts. I was wondering about that because you'd imagine that this stately craft at 8 knots, huge yoke, moving relatively slowly, it seemed to be aiming at the pier.
Yes, if it locked on the course in which it was doing, it should go between the two, through the central part of that bridge, because that's what it's designed to do. The bridge goes over and has no obstacles, but it appeared to veer to the right. So I wonder did the rudder get a hard over and get stuck onto the particular angle? Because had it been on the track in which it was intended to go, the track made good, as we call it, it should have gone straight out. Even
if everything failed, given its weight and speed, it
and
would
the
have
angle,
kept
it should
going.
Have gone straight through and not collided with any of
those. We've often heard how long it takes to turn a super tanker around and so on. So if this power failure had happened and the boat was properly aimed, so you've no power, how long before it drifted to a stop?
Probably 1.5 or 2 nautical miles. It's a huge energy to try and stop like that. There's also some evidence that they tried to deploy the stern anchor, which would, of course, delay it and slow the speed like that, but all too little and all too late. I don't know why it turned right, but it did. So they had a very serious failure.
It's not possible that the anchor swung it round?
The examination of all of the documentation and all of the track, the records. Good news is that they've got a black box, not a cockpit voice recorder, but a flight data recorder, in this case a ship data recorder, which has been recovered, and it will tell them exactly what power was on, what happened, what systems were put in place.
It's worrying because when we talk about aircraft, we talk about redundancy being built into the control system.
Yes,
so
indeed.
You've got a backup computer and a backup to the backup.
Yes, and in fly-by-wire aircraft, you've got three different systems, all of which, you know, have to correspond or work, and any one of them, if it fails, will have, you know, still redundancy. So on the ship, there must be no redundancy in that regard.
Now, looking at the engineering of the bridge, a 1970s bridge, it looked, from the video of the crash, it looked flimsy. But then when you see the close-up pictures of the tangled metal and so on,
indeed,
it was substantially built, but it's the design which may have been at fault.
There are dozens of thousands of tons of metal put in there, all in good condition, designed to be cantilevered, which means, you know, it supports its own. Otherwise, you'd have to put a support in the middle of the piece where the ship's going in and out. So that's why
if you've
designed.
Got two sections of bridge,
yes,
but each would stand alone in theory.
Yeah.
And then they're joined up in the middle.
Exactly. And the bit in the middle then is supported both. So if you lose a leg left or right, it's quite likely the middle piece will come down. But that balances then in turn other spans. And unfortunately, when you lose one, you lose them all, as happened. It was a sequential failing of the bridge.
They were saying in Baltimore, in the analysis of Baltimore, that there are techniques, that the modern techniques, given the size of these ships, that would prevent this happening, because if a new bridge is built, there would be a kind of a sandbank, not a sandbank, concrete bank, whatever it would built that would be a buffer. That would slow the ship down.
And that has been the case in the bridge between, for example, Denmark and Sweden, which I've seen and gone across like that. It's a fabulous piece of construction. It's done to the highest possible standards. But even having put these things around it, I'm not sure that the energy of a ship that weighs 95,000 tons and is travelling at 8 knots in a particular direction, I'm not sure the bank they've put around it, the support, would actually stop it tipping or crashing into the
particular from my school days and indeed engineering days, MV is the momentum, the velocity multiplied by the mass.
Indeed.
And that is constant. So, if the ship is slowing down, it's transferring that to whatever it hits.
Exactly the point. And I don't know that there's anything in Europe or other parts of the world that will stop a 95,000-ton ship, which is heading for your bridge. And if you've got a failure there, you're in serious problems. So it's a matter they're going to have to look at, because the ports around the world are getting bigger and bigger. 95,000 tons is not the heaviest ship that's on the seas at the moment.
Yeah.
And the same is true, by the way, of tankers which come in and out of port, because they are in enormous weight and they've got incredible energies behind
them. And the captains of these ships have got to plan their braking, if you like.
Absolutely. It's done like an aviation. You know, you've got to work out in many kilometres in advance you have got to stop. And there are routes in and out of certain ports which are quite complex, turns and so forth. All of this has to be done
Now, the implications for Baltimore, first of all, the port is closed.
Yes.
It's blocked by the fallen bridge and by the ship. There are ships trapped within, and ships aiming for Baltimore would have to divert to other places.
There's at least a dozen ships outside the port trying to get in now, trying to find places to berth, as it were. The problem with the ship is they have to unload the 4,700 containers, or most of them, to try and refloat it, pull it backwards, and then look at the damage. At the same time, they have to have massive floating cranes to remove the debris of the standard. That many,
so they're going to have to bring another container vessel alongside,
probably, which is complex,
and then move the containers onto the other ship.
And as you know, when you're unloading at a port, it's a remarkably slick operation with cranes which move literally every second. They take these things in, and to do it at sea when you're floating with another ship,
and they've
got
to keep
complex.
It stable as
well, and make sure it won't damage or leak any of its fuel out and that kind of thing.
So having done that, and presumably the tugs then can get this thing off the remnants of the bridge, then they've got to clear the steel away.
And that's the problem. How many? 50,000 tonnes, 100,000 tonnes like that? Some of which is wedged at the bottom of the sea. So it's quite a complex. Again, you're using floating cranes because it's a complex at-sea operation. Not easy and not swift either.
So what are the implications for global trade? Because this is one of, you know, maybe a dozen ports in the United States. It's a significant, very important
port. It certainly
is
that, yes.
But it will have knockback effects. The ships that should have delivered their cargo and picked up new cargo are stalled.
Yes.
So who knows where this is going to end?
Well, a ship's officer told me that every delay of a ship that size is maybe $400,000, $500,000 of lost earnings in that regard. So you have to have a plan. We saw what happened when the Red Sea was closed and when the Suez Canal got blocked. Yeah. I mean, now, it won't affect us in the short term, but it will affect markets in the US and other parts, because 750,000 cars come in and out of Baltimore port alone. It was a major port. A lot of the grain, a lot of the stuff that goes in and out, oil and coal and so forth. So there will be a blip in that regard. They're very resilient, though, and they will put in extra energies into other places. But there aren't that many spare capacities. If you've got, 50 or 60 or 100
ships. A booming
ships,
economy in the United States.
It's very hard to book. There were outside Los Angeles port, myself, there were days of waiting to get your ship in to load and unload. So it's quite a complex matter.
Yeah, and meantime in China, you've got cargo on the dock waiting for the ship.
Yeah.
And the ship is stuck outside
LA.
And
it's 7 or 8 days lost then. So everything has a knock-on effect to us. So it could affect us here in regards to sugar, believe it or not, because we import a lot of our sugar from the USA. So it's a complex matter. The supply chains have been hit many, many times before. This is just another blip on that road.
All right. Kevin Byrne, Lieutenant Colonel, retired, and Airport Safety and Security Auditor, and expert, it appears, on maritime matters as well. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.